Good evening. I'd like to welcome everyone. My name's Peter Tribowitz. I teach in the International Relations Department here and head up the U.S. Center at the LSE, which is sponsoring tonight's roundtable discussion. So one of the things that the U.S. Center seeks to do is promote deeper understanding of American politics, and boy, oh boy, do we need that now. Last night, Donald Trump threw all the over all the conventional wisdoms about who would show up on Election Day. Turns out there really was a class of missing voters. Not what it takes to win the presidency. Turns out you don't need a well-organized machine, just a Twitter account. And about political analysts' ability to track public sentiment. Turns out American pollsters have nothing on their British counterparts. So it's been a day of shock, if not awe, to borrow a phrase. It's also a day, I think, to reflect on what Benjamin Franklin said in the summer of 1787. Emerging from the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, Franklin was asked what form of government had been agreed upon. Franklin replied, "A republic, if you can keep it." America has voted and elected Donald Trump, its 45th president, and the question now is what that's going to mean going forward for the United States, to be sure, but also for the rest of the world, and that's what we're here to talk about tonight. And who better to help get us started than Justin Webb of Today on Radio 4, longtime commentator on the American scene, and most importantly, one of LSE's alums. So, Justin, the floor is yours. He's going to introduce everybody and get us started.
Thank you very much indeed, and it's a real pleasure to be here. And I'm delighted as well that so many people have turned out and that there aren't a lot of empty seats as people have given up on American politics, which was at least a slight fear. We're going to discuss, obviously, what happened. I hope also we will get on to, well, I know also we'll get on to what happens next, which is, of course, equally important, in fact, more important now, you could argue. And we've got some guests here who are absolutely the right people to discuss that. There is this sense in Britain when people look at American politics that it is all of it the power of the presidency. And of course the power of the presidency is huge and is much discussed and is or is not even imperial on occasions. But it's also, of course, interestingly limited by the Constitution. And as Barack Obama was making very clear about an hour or so ago when he spoke, by the rule of law and by the way in which America does things. I don't know if any of you remember when Barack Obama was elected in 2008, all the newspaper headlines, those rather pedantic headlines that they like in the New York Times and the Washington Post, Barack Obama elected president, 44th president is Obama, etc., etc. My favorite headline was in the Onion, the satirical newspaper, and their headline was, "Black man given nation's worst job." So now that job goes to Donald Trump, and it will be fascinating and white-knuckle ride invigorating to see what he makes of it. So, on my immediate left here, Bronwyn Maddox is here, Director of the Institute of Government, former editor and chief executive of Prospect magazine as well, and chief foreign commentator on The Times. Cheryl Shonhug Bailey is next to Nigel there, next to your teacher, and you will know her. Well, I suppose you won't always know her. You won't all know her, will you? But anyway, she is known well in the school as a professor of political science. Sir Nigel Sheinwald was a British ambassador to the US when I was there. In other words, he is a pretty recent ambassador. The thing is about ambassadors, there are, over the years, there are quite a few of them, and you can go back, and I'm not suggesting that those who were there donkeys years ago don't know anything anymore. I'm not suggesting that for a minute. But Nigel, we are delighted to have here because he is someone who is still contemporaneous in the context that he has. And Peter, did you introduce yourself in a kind of proper way at the very beginning?
I think you kind of did.
I want to start with what happened. Then, as I say, we'll go on to what happens next, etc. We'll have a general conversation. We'll get as much in as we can. And then we really will throw it open. And we've got plenty of time to go where people want to take us. So let's start with what happened first. And Bronwyn, if you can kick us off. Why did we get the result that we got?
Donald Trump managed to speak to a lot of people that we weren't sure he was speaking to, who really found something, a resonance that really meant a lot to them in his message of Washington is broken, the political system is broken, drain the swamp, as he put it. I will get your jobs back. I will shield you from the cold winds of globalization and trade. I will put up a wall. I will shield you from the immigrants sweeping the planet who have taken your jobs. And you did have these forlorn voices like Thomas Friedman, the New York Times, saying to Trump voters, your jobs have gone to a microchip, not to Mexico. But even so, he managed with that message to speak to a lot of people who did not want to hear any other kind of message, from, particularly from someone representing the Washington establishment. And why the pollsters got it wrong, I think we'll learn more in coming days. But what was very clear, watching the results come in last night, was that he particularly found there were two sorts of surprises. The Midwest and the Rust Belt, part of the Midwest, and particularly parts of Wisconsin, Michigan, to some extent Pennsylvania, parts of the country which had lost a lot of jobs, a lot of factories and so on, he found untapped pockets of resentment, if you like. He got more support there than anyone had been expecting. And Hillary Clinton's campaign had been referring to that part of the country as the blue wall of defense, and she hadn't even gone to parts of it since about April. And that blue wall crumbled quite comprehensively last night. And then one of the other questions we've got is that quite a lot of Hispanics seem to have turned out for Donald Trump in a way that the pollsters did not predict. And that's one of the things I want to know more about, particularly in Florida, I think.
Nigel?
Well, just looking back a bit, I'd start by saying that it's actually quite difficult for an American two-term president to be succeeded by someone of the same party. So although we always saw Hillary Clinton as the favourite in this election to get her nomination and then to become president, actually it's quite hard. And in recent times, you have to go back to George Bush winning in 88. It's quite hard to do that. And then, agreeing with Bronwyn, I would say there are some general and some specific reasons. The general ones are the ones to do with the rejection of the establishment, the way that Trump was able to capitalize on that, tapping into something which we're quite familiar with here in Europe and particularly here in Britain in some ways, though the expression of it may be more extreme in American politics and economics. But I would say also it's to do with the candidate that was opposing Trump. It was also partly about the weakness of Hillary Clinton as a candidate. And Mario Cuomo, who was the New York governor in the 80s, had that phrase about you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose. Well, there was certainly very little poetry of any kind in this campaign, but certainly there was very little in Hillary Clinton's platform and presentation of the issues, which really infused voters. And I think one of the analysts over the last few days said, you know, how do you ensure really high turnout when you're not inspiring people and motivating them, really getting them off their seats? And I think that was, if you look back, one of the problems throughout the period after the conventions was Hillary's inability to really close the issue and run the table in the way that a really convincing candidate would have done. I think she would have made a competent and good president, but she was in 2008 and again this year a poor campaigner. Lastly, James Comey. Difficult to know quite how many hundreds of thousands or millions of votes to attribute to his decision to reopen the whole issue of the private email server, but it did mean that the last 2 weeks of the campaign were about her and her dishonesty, alleged dishonesty, and her problems, and it took all the pressure off him in a way, just at the time when he was recoiling from the allegations against him. So those will be the reasons I give. Sorry,
Cheryl, do you believe that another candidate of those who were the likely and actual candidates this time could have won against him?
Yes, I think so. I mean, and I think at different times he could have been knocked off the search for his own party's nomination. It's conceivable to me that had Jeb Bush showed up at the right time in the right moment, his own path, which looks sort of ineluctable now, looking back on it, could have been disturbed. So I think it's possible, and I don't know whether Bernie Sanders could possibly have beaten him, but he's a similar sort of candidate who challenges the other side and who tries to tap into that the raw discontent and economic inequalities, which do seem to have won the
could certainly have fought him in the Rust Belt, couldn't he? That's exactly the point about Sanders. Cheryl, from your perspective, was it her weakness, or was it some strength in him that was found during the course of the campaign?
Well, let me start by saying, actually, I'll differentiate my perspective on it a little bit by pointing out the contextual factors. And a lot has been made about the parallels with Brexit. And I think there are some quite valid parallels. I think that there were, building a little bit on what Broman had said, there was a swathe of discontent, of malaise, among American voters that had been simmering, a simmering rage for some time. And he was the right man at the right time to tap into and exploit that rage. So the rage, and it goes back decades, so issues of economic inequality, a growing sense of distrust in American political institutions, so the ongoing political polarization in Congress and then spreading to the American electorate. Moreover, a media that, and this is a difference, I think, between the UK and the US, a media where there is no common outlet that most could agree would give a valid, factual perception of reality. So you had multiple realities going on among the American electorate. People that I had spoken to who were very close relatives and friends who were Trump supporters simply could not fathom voting, anyone in their right mind voting for Hillary Clinton. And so there was no sense of weighing up the candidates in a way that would give justice to the facts, and it was a sort of a misperception on the part of the electorate. So that's a media story that I think others might be able to comment on. So I think that some of those factors are common with Brexit that essentially created an opportunity for Trump to step in and exploit them. And I think also, as Nigel has pointed out, within the Republican Party, the lack of consensus around an alternative candidate within the party itself in the primaries gave him full rein to plow through the primaries because there wasn't a clear alternative to stand up to Trump. So I think I think that political scientists will study 2016 for generations to come.
do we know, though, Peter, that what happened was new people came to the polls who hadn't voted before? I mean, is it as plain as that? Do we know, in other words, in any kind of granular detail, what actually happened?
Well, we know something from the exit polls already, but we'll know more in the coming days. But yeah, there were new voters who showed up, and that's the surprise here.
Because this is what he said he'd do, isn't it?
It's what he said he'd do. He would go out and he would get kind of blue-collar, non-college-educated white voters. You know, remember he said how he loved the uneducated? And now we can see why. Because they turned out, there's an incredible graphic on the front page of the New York Times that shows kind of the movement of voters across the country. And you can see that the Republican people were moving to the Republican Party in the manufacturing, you know, the traditional manufacturing belt, the Rust Belt states. The fact that he picked the lock on Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, these are two states that are bedrock Democratic states. They've been voting Democratic, Wisconsin, since the 1980s. And he may still win Michigan before this is over. It's too close to call right now, unless it's been called in the last few minutes. So I think that the theory going in was that there was a class of voters, a group of voters, that the Republican Party itself was ignoring, and that the Democrats were no longer catering to. These were traditional Democratic voters, and they weren't catering to them too, and that he could identify issues, and this goes all the way back to the points that were made earlier. He could speak to the anger and the resentment that they had about globalization, losing their jobs because of technological change, and just being left behind, and to mobilize them. And what's incredible is he did this without a machine. So this was like a wave that showed up. I mean, the other thing that you can see in the exit polls, again, the polls keep changing. The exit polls is kind of like more, more voice. I think they have hundreds of thousands that are in it, and every couple hours it's updated. But one of the things that just very briefly is that you see that 60% of Americans, according to these polls, now maybe they're no more reliable than the polls that predicted the election result, made up their mind in September. What's interesting is there were about 12% of the voters who made up their minds in the last 2 weeks. So I think there were structural factors, but I think there's a Comey factor here also. And what I think Comey did was he reminded, I don't think this is necessarily why he did it, but that he reminded Republicans, especially white college-educated Republicans who had misgivings about Trump, to come home, to get off the fence, and they did. He also won them. Just, you know, people were saying this was going to be the first election since 1952 that a Democrat won white college-educated, majority of white college-educated voters. Yeah. She didn't.
That point about that Cheryl raised about media, Bronwyn Maddox, was the reporting of it and the questioning or lack of questioning of the candidates partly to blame?
I don't think it was a lack of questioning of the candidates. You did have a polarization of the media. As we've just been discussing, you had some media who hated Trump or really didn't like him. And if you look at the New York Times coverage this evening, it's very black in terms of what it's kind of foreseeing from now on. And Trump certainly played on this, saying, you know, they hate me. They never show they show the protesters when I come out. They never show the protesters when Hillary comes out. And their media are bad people, he kept saying. But equally, there were the conservative media going for Hillary and making the most of the emails. So I think very much as we've been discussing, was a polarization, and people are able to live more than you can here with the BBC and others. Live in a kind of world. Where the media supports their own view of things, and it's too extreme to talk about post-truth, you know, politics. It's kind of a selection of the facts, a portrayal of the world that supports your view. If you're in a, you know, a red state, if you're in a red state of mind, you watch the media that support that. You mix with friends who support that, and the same if you're in a Democrat state. And we've seen that kind of polarization in a very marked way in America for some time now. Even though we've had about 20 years of presidents saying we're here to heal the rifts in America, we've seen this polarization growing and people just selecting the kind of media that support their own view. But I don't think it's fair to say that either candidate was unchallenged. It just didn't stick home.
Can I add something to that? So one other thing that I think is related to the media perception of the campaign is, trying to phrase this gently,
No, you don't have to do that. We're all grown-ups.
Is Trump's embracing of anti-political correctness. And so that every, I mean, from over a year ago, you know, we thought, oh, you know, he said this completely ludicrous, you know, slamming McCain and so on and so on and so on. That's the end of Trump. And so the media would say, oh, that's the end of it. He can't survive. And so I think this is one of the really intriguing things about this campaign, is that he thrived on that. He not only surmounted those difficulties, he thrived on it. And it was an endorsement of, absolutely, I don't speak like those establishment folks. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I speak like you. Yeah. I say things that are politically incorrect. Yeah. So I think there is also a cultural dimension there where you have a swathe of kind of a cultural movement toward political correctness, that there's a segment of the American population that assesses that as too much, too fast to accept.
Mm. Kind of foreseen by Samuel Huntington in that book. I can't remember the title, but he brought out a book. Is it This Is Our Country or Our Country? Mm. Who's read Huntington? You're all academics.
His last book. What's
but
the
I mean,
title
foreseen by academics on the kind of right, centre-right some time ago, that if we don't handle this properly, this being the cultural mix, not just race, but actually more wide than that, then we will face this kind of discord. And you're saying that's what's happened, and the language actually is
part of it. Sexual harassment tape. I mean, it did damage him in the polls, but not that much, and it didn't stick for that long. No. And then when James Comey came in with the reminder of the emails, you could see the tape that had seemed so damaging. As you said, another instance, but surely this one has killed Joff Trump. No, it hadn't. It just faded away.
Yeah, so every time the New York Times attacked him, his stock went up. You know, that was like, it was like he wore it like a badge of honor.
Mm-hmm. And but are we saying that this is now, it's almost inevitable, that once you've tapped into that and once you have found a way of connecting and getting relative impunity for saying, outrageous and offensive and aggressive things, that's now a new normal, which we're just going to have to get used to. And indeed, there's something good about it if people are communicating in clear and forceful language with public rather than the sort of weasel words that politicians that Justin interviews every morning come up with. Are we saying that that's inevitable and there's a good part of it? Or are we saying that ultimately responsibility means that politicians are going to have to come back to the centre, and governing requires a different type of discourse, and that he'll find that once he is in negotiations with the Congress or nominating people to the Supreme Court or doing normal politics, that actually something different is required.
Which brings us very neatly, Nigel, to what happens now. Not what happens in governing terms now, but I want to just start with a sort of transition, because Obama, I don't know if anyone saw, talked about the transition when he spoke publicly on the lawn of the White House about 2 hours or so ago, and said Trump is going to come into the White House tomorrow and see Obama, and they're going to do everything they can, as they always say now, but he looked like he really meant it. They're going to do everything that they can to make it as smooth as possible. Secretary of State, Treasury Secretary, any ideas? John Bolton, Secretary of State, I saw somewhere. You welcome that, Nigel?
No, I wouldn't, but but I'm sure there are many worse people out there who could be Secretary of State.
But how much does it matter, actually, that it gets relatively what the wider American public would regard as grown-up people around him now? And what are the chances that he will?
Well, I think it is important. It depends what you want. I mean, if you want, as I think this country and our Western European partners and most American allies around the world want, which is a higher degree of predictability and more searching for the common ground that he talked about in his statement last night. If you want that to be real, then he has to adjust, amend, go back on some of the things that he said on the campaign trail. And he has to listen to people about the international world, about which he doesn't know a huge amount. And that means, I think, having people who are prepared to speak clearly and in plain language to him. So I don't know who he'll choose. It's a mug's game to do that at this stage. But I think there will be enough mainstream Republicans who, when asked by a president-elect to serve, may well decide, unlike what they said 6 months ago, that they will do it, and they will see whether they can establish some sort of rapport with him.
Yeah. That's an important point, isn't it?
Yes. I think so. I mean, he comes to office not just with no really worked-up policies in the international arena, but without a sort of network of advisers and people that you can judge him by. And that's been quite deliberate, and it's his style. And I think one would worry a great deal if this was somebody who was going to govern as he's campaigned, really by himself, with the tight family group only, the only group really that had any impact on him, and without a wider set of professional and policy advisers.
Chair?
Let me just add, just try to look at this positively, all right? Let's try. One of the things about Trump is that he's not a traditional ideologue, not in the sense that we understand an ideologue in an American political sense. And in this sense, we can perhaps take some comfort from that. So that's not going to be constraining him in his choices. He's quite happy to change his views quite drastically, day in and day out. And so we can hope that, in a positive sense, will facilitate some adaptability in his willingness to take on the so-called the best and the brightest. Now, okay, what's the yardstick that he's going to use to judge the best and the brightest? And I don't know. I mean, I'm clueless on that. But we can hope that at least he is adaptable enough to not be fixed in a stringent sort of ideological mode.
Peter, do you think he will?
Just to go back to the original question, so on Secretary of State, so there's talk about Newt Gingrich and Attorney General Rudy Giuliani. So I don't know what that leaves for Chris Christie. I agree with Nigel in that I think what we're going to see is...
Nigel says transport secretary for Chris Christie, which is a good idea.
Charge of bridges.
That's good. So what was I thinking? What I was going to say is I think, you know, a lot of Republicans that served in George W. Bush's administration have, especially on the foreign policy side, have sat this out and, in fact, wrote protest letters and petitions against Trump. And I think what we'll probably see, both for instrumental reasons but also for patriotic reasons, these people start to make their CVs available. And the bottom line is Trump has to have people to turn the lights on, to kind of like the shop has to be run. So I think some of those people will come in. I think one of the interesting dynamics will be the relationship between him and Paul Ryan going forward, so the Speaker of the House. And when you think about like what they agree on and what that might mean, so they're on the same page with very large tax cuts. They're both, Trump has called for that. That's clearly where Ryan is. Trump has called for rolling back Obamacare. That's where Ryan is as well. Ryan takes a very aggressive position on Medicaid also. Trump, less so. It's kind of block grants and like pushing it off to the states to try to deal with it. But there are opportunities there for them to push an agenda, actually, that's we haven't seen for a while.
Although when it comes to spending money, and you think of the infrastructure proposals, so and you think of Ryan's kind of, I mean, and the whole of small government conservatism that was the Republican Party, or the what we thought of as the Republican Party, at least since Reagan. How does that work?
So just on the points of tension would be Trump's call. This is actually something that was very similar between, in a sense, Trump and Clinton. They both favored infrastructure spending. So that's not a typical Republican, this goes to your point about ideology, it's not a typical Republican position. But it is a position, a policy, set of positions that will appeal to those voters that Trump brought into the system. And another area where there are real differences is over trade policy. So most Republicans that are in Congress favor TPP, they favor TTIP. I think Trump's made it pretty clear that's not a high priority for him.
Yeah. But Bronwyn, given how unideological he is, to use a positive glass, could he just say of all the trade stuff, oh, yeah, okay, well, maybe it won't work if you persuade me. I'll think about something. I mean, can he draw plainly TTIP?
Well, look, we've got plenty of
plenty of things that are finished, but does he get more aggressive, go after China, or does he say, okay, that's the end of it? And actually, when it comes to it, do very little more on trade than Hillary Clinton would have found herself forced into doing?
I don't know. I think trade is one of the first tests, and so is Obamacare. Mm. What he does on those two things, and obviously his relationship with Congress, where many Republicans have lined up to be very rude about him, and are doing their own U-turns. That is crucial. What he does on trade, yes, he can begin to unpick NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, very very quickly. So that has to be the first test, I think, not just TTIP, which is, as you said, I think is now dead. So that's one test, and that's what Mexico is clearly worried about, and indeed Canada. And I think it's hard. I mean, he's not ideological in the sense of sort of conventional party ideology, but he has made some things sort of planks of what he's said, and trade has been absolutely one of them. I'm going to get your jobs back, and I'm going to do it by unpicking these trade deals which have been so bad for you. So I think it'd be surprising if he did a big reversal on that. I mean, yes, we can think of other areas where he's whirled round and round. The Washington Post said he had five positions on abortion within 3 days. But on trade, I'd be surprised if he didn't stick to his word and do some things that unpick those things. And then we've got, obviously, kind of Supreme Court questions after that. And that's really looming, because the Congress has been saying, no, we're not going to approve Obama's choice of the next justice, so it's been stuck at eight justices. That one is really right there in the in-tray, and he may well have a couple more. So we've got some things very quickly which will show what we're supposed to make of him.
Nigel, on the trade?
No, just briefly on that. I mean, and being encouraged to be positive for a moment, I think the question is, you know, how much red meat does this incoming president need? Because he doesn't need to keep all of the campaign promises that he's made, I think, in order to placate the base and feel that he's being real and making America great again. Does he have to do all of renouncing the Paris Agreement, tearing up the agreement with Iran, putting in an ideologically right-wing set of successors on the Supreme Court, annulling Obamacare, you know, the list
just
of...
Just build the wall.
Build the wall, whatever it is. I would have thought that it's possible to imagine that there are some conceivable trade-offs between those things which can allow part of that agenda to be moderated in some way if he wants to, and if he's encouraged down that path, for example, by the congressional leadership, number one. And number two, within those things, he can have a trade policy which looks very different from Obama Mark II, remembering that in Obama's first term, very little happened on trade. This is something he's developed in his second term. It can look very different, but maybe not every single thing needs to get suspended, be stuck, whatever. Our little parochial interest in this country is that in a couple of years' time, we might want to be doing a trade deal with the United States bilaterally. And that you can see as something which he might not want, for his own reasons, to throw out of the window.
Mm. Let's turn more widely to foreign affairs. And actually, I might come back to you, Nigel, to kick us off. So if we put trade to one side, You think of his attitude to NATO, you think of what he said about what's going on in Syria and Iraq. What can he do? What do you think he will do, and what do you think the parameters are within which he's working?
Well, I mean, if you start with some of the things which are of greatest importance to us here in Europe, and I think we can still say that in the UK, I think that with NATO, I think that he has every reason to carry on asking the European members of NATO to do more. That's something which a number of presidents have done, and from a UK perspective, actually, that would be quite helpful if it were successful. But I do think the bit of the mainstream agenda he has to adopt is to understand that for America to be great, it has to use its alliances properly. There's been a debate about whether Obama has ever done that to the extent he could have done, but surely it's something which needs to be re-emphasized, both for NATO, but also for America's traditional alliances with Japan, in the Middle East, and so on. I think if he jettisons all of that, then that is, to use the words of some of the commentators today, that is the end of the Western alliance and the concept of the West as we've known it in the past six decades.
All right, but this is where we really don't know what he's going to do. He sounded very friendly towards Russia, very sceptical of the effort and money that America is putting into these foreign alliances, including NATO, and the world doesn't stand still. And the Baltic states are very anxious at the moment, not just of grand dramatic things like a Russian military action towards them, but Russia's president offering more and more passports to try and recruit the Russian-speaking populations within them. And at the back of their minds or in the front of their minds, what would the U.S. really do if they called on NATO to defend them against Russia? And the point is, we just don't know. And the world doesn't stand still. It comes up with all kinds of provocations and challenges, which we would, in many cases, want the U.S. to respond to. And we don't, again, know who his advisors are. You're talking about the ones, from the Bush administration. Well, many of those have a rock on their CVs, as you put it, and which makes it hard to know what they would do in these new circumstances and in the Middle East. We don't have many guides to what he would do.
Yeah, I mean, just to follow on that point, we don't know what he will do. I think the thing about his election is that it's deeply unsettling, and it's introduced a kind of new level of uncertainty. And one side of this is, allies are thinking about, in foreign capitals, the question is, how credible are America's commitments going forward, right? Whether it's in Tokyo or, in Vilnius or in Berlin. But there's the other side of this, which is, how are Beijing and Moscow calculating now? So, I mean, the question is whether or not all of the emphasis on focusing on problems at home, saying that the United States is not going to be in the business of providing international public goods like collective security in the future, will lead them to kind of probe and test. And I would expect so.
Mm-hmm. And do you also believe that this sort of sense that America's commitment to the post-Second War settlement, in the widest sense, to keeping the shipping lanes open and all the rest of it, that kind of whole thing is, as Nigel said, well, I'm not sure whether you were suggesting or whether you were suggesting others were suggesting, is kind of at an end, actually, now. I mean, is that what we're saying?
Well, I don't know if it's at an end, but I think that suddenly there's a lot of uncertainty about the level of America's commitment. And it's not because, at least I don't think, it's because foreign capitals think the United States doesn't have the capacity. It's the question is will, right? And whether this election is, I mean, there were already concerns that Obama was retrenching and pulling back. And so I think the question right now is this, are we going to see this go in fast forward now?
I think it might be. coming to an end, and that's what this presidency will show. Mm. If you take the three things we've been talking about, scepticism about NATO and unwillingness to take part in it, scepticism about the Iran deal, scepticism about the Paris climate change deal, it's a view which says, look, really, are these international deals, this kind of rule-based international order that has been what America has created and upheld really since the Second World War, is that really something in America's own interest anymore? And I think that does signal a real change.
And I think, just to complete the thought, I mean, I think that not only is that very worrying, and worrying, frankly, enough, but you could see a situation in which you have quite a passive and pacific American Trump policy most of the time. But then when it doesn't work, the pressures suddenly get very, very great, and the pressure on him to do something very, very quickly and quite dramatic could really make things difficult, and you could see a military escalation or whatever, because the hardware will be there and the capacity of the United States to intervene is there. It's just that it won't have been tested. And I think that oscillation, that unpredictability, that seesawing is a worry if he doesn't have a sort of more natural, moderate approach.
Against that, there are those who say, has been absolutely, Obama has been really played around with by Putin. And in other words, what you're doing at the moment doesn't work. Hasn't worked broadly and hasn't worked specifically with Syria. So perhaps trying something different and having a genuine reset of the relationship with Putin might produce something.
Right. If Nixon, why did he look at me? If Nixon can go to China, I guess Trump can go to Moscow.
We've had that in looking into Putin's eyes and all this business. But
right, we've had that before. Right. His soul. Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah.
Did you want to finish the thought?
No, I think I'll leave it there.
Let me just add one thing to that.
Yes. Just yeah. Inchoate. Right?
Was that because the thought was too terrible to finish or just you reached a natural end? Cheryl.
So one of the worries is that he's going to tackle all this at once. But what we've seen, particularly in the Obama administration, is that, even though he has this large administration at his disposal, there's only so much that he can focus on at once. So I think a big question is he actually going to devote himself more to U.S. domestic policy? I mean, he did say America first, right? America first. We're going to see through the lens of, what's good for America. And I suspect that actually he's not going to be paying that much close attention, and probably Nigel's right. He's sort of letting it go steady state until something blows up, and focusing on this sort of America first strategy in the immediate future. And that could be a good thing or a bad thing.
I wish I thought the world had a steady state at the moment. But it keeps... presenting dramas.
Do you think him as a person, I'm going to throw it open to people to take it in other directions now, but as a person, has he got what it takes? Because he's got a certain something about him, hasn't he? How can I put this? I should say I interviewed him once on Doncaster Railway Station. He wasn't there. I was on Doncaster. The Today programme prides itself with a deep research, an effort that goes into sorting out its interviews. And I was at Doncaster Railway Station. I think I was attending a UKIP annual conference, or possibly on my way back. And someone rang for the office and says, "You've got to talk to this American businessman, Donald Trump. You've got to do it now." And I said, "Oh, what's it about?" And he said, "Golf. He's really keen on golf." And it was, it wasn't that long ago. It was a couple of years ago. And it was about Turnberry and his interest in Scotland in particular, but in Ireland as well. And I tagged on a question, I should say, on the end of it, being not next to Google on my train in Doncaster, but remembering from my time in the United States that he had threatened to run, indeed, kind of sort of run in the past. So I said he intended to run it. I mean, he could not have been more kind of upbeat and charming and actually quite thoughtful about it. And we played it out on the Today programme, and hilariously, lots of people complained and said, why are you talking to this man about whether he's running for office? Obviously, no chance at all that he's going to do that, you idiot. So, yeah, just shows. But my point being that he is capable of sometimes being more of a person who is a person of substance than he seems when you look at him in his public persona. And I just wonder whether, and you think naturally back to George W. Bush, who, you know, again, people hoped, and sometimes he was and sometimes he wasn't. He'd just be capable of rising to an occasion, just as the mover and shaker that the president has to be. And you've seen this at close quarters, Nigel. It is important, isn't it, that he charms, he cajoles, he twists arms, he does things with a degree of subtlety that you don't see when you look at him on the screen, but it's kind of got to be there.
And that's, I think, one of the very, very big questions, and again, one of the many don't knows. But his friends say, and whether they're just saying this for effect or whether it's because they genuinely believe it, and this comes from an interview on your programme this morning, you know, his friends would say, this is a man who is pragmatic, who can do deals, who can negotiate, and who is not afraid to have very clever people around him who he listens to. Now, that's the problem for us is that there is quite a dissonance between that and the person that we've seen on the campaign trail who hasn't liked having anyone around him who's not a member of his own family. So it's quite a big stretch to imagine this happening, but it's conceivable that in his private life, in his business life, about which there's, of course, a great deal of controversy in itself, but that a different person might emerge. And you need a huge range of skills, I think, to be an effective president. As Obama showed, he had, you know, one skill set that was very, very clear, but the cajoling, politicking, negotiating side of being an American president wasn't there to the same extent and in the same force as his communications and moral skills, moral virtues.
I mean, I think that's the point. We've seen his almost endless capacity to define himself as a winner, and indeed now to win. What we don't know is that where that sort of gives way to narcissism, whether he defines everything he does as right in itself. We haven't seen much evidence that he's a politician with the kind of skills that Nigel has just been describing. But I agree with you. I mean, he seems less startled to find himself heading for the White House than, say, George W. did. I remember interviewing George W. And Jeb Bush when they were both governors, and George W. said, well, I didn't... George W. beginning to run for president, he said, well, I didn't grow up expecting to, you know, run for president or be president. And Jeb piped up and said, well, I did. and there was a tentativeness at points about George W., which I guess some people found, you know, part of his charm. Yeah. George, that's not what you say of Donald Trump.
But
we don't know.
He could also use a kind of sweet sort of almost vulnerability, W., when you know, I interviewed him towards the end of his time, did this interview with him where he says at the end of it, how was that for you? Was that good? Did you like it? And I said, thank you very much, Mr. President. Before you go, do you want to see the Oval Office? So I said, yes, please. We went to the Oval Office. Do you want to see the Rose Garden? We'll go out to the Rose Garden. Do you want to see the Library Corridor? We went down to the Library Corridor. I actually found myself saying to the President of the United States, look, I'm terribly sorry, but I somewhere else. And, you know, it's whether... But that's a kind of tool, actually, that W would use, certainly as I saw it, and very occasionally behind the scenes, and that really does matter, and I'm not sure... Well, I mean, we don't know, do we, frankly? But you sort of hope that he can develop himself as a person away from just the narcissism into something.
We don't know. Lots we don't know.
That's why you're all paid the big bucks.
Well, maybe the Institute.
But that will not be an acceptable answer to our first question, which is a chap right at the back, and then we'll take a few, actually, and take them in sequence. Yes, sir. Shoot. If you can hold on for a second, we'll get a microphone up to you. Just right back at the very end, please, at the very, very top, as far away from you as you fear. Here we go. And if we keep everything as pithy as possible, please.
Michael Mashinsky, International Relations here 30 years ago. There's clearly something about the man to have pulled off the victory he had, but what does it say about democracy when also looked in the context of Brexit, that these victories have actually perhaps done something for democracy in getting more people out to vote who never voted before?
Yep, good point. There was someone down the front here. Could we come down to the front? Down the front. Here we go. Hang on, it's coming from the front to you. Shoot.
Hello. Michel Dineshi, an alumni. I want to know whether you think he's going to go after Hillary and try to put her into prison.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll take that one.
Spokeswoman wouldn't say when she was asked that on CNN this afternoon. Yeah, the chap up there on the... Right, and then we'll come up to you. Yeah.
Hello, Carl Hector, A-level politics teacher. Just referring to your final discussion there about whether he's interested in actually being president, I understand that while his family were recruiting for a vice president, they said, we're after someone who can do both foreign policy and domestic policy, and Donald would be in charge of making America great again. Would that not be the model, or rather like the George W. and Cheney model, where there's a power behind the throne and he actually just spends more time with his golf?
Pence as Cheney. Take any one of them. Peter, kick off.
On the Hillary question, no. So I think he signaled it last night in his, you know, his acceptance speech. I would be very surprised. He took the high road, it seemed to me, with respect to her. But just on the Pence question and Pence's Cheney, I don't think Pence has the same kind of the breadth of experience, in a sense, that Cheney had, where Cheney could work both the domestic and the foreign policy side. I'll tell you one thing that I worry a little bit about is that the way that he'll govern is with a kitchen cabinet. And that there will be a number of people that Newt actually won't go to state, or Giuliani won't go to attorney general, but that they will be very close to him, and that these will be people that are not accountable, right, but very close to him.
But that is, I think, absolutely normal in politics everywhere, I'm afraid. It's just one of those things, and it's always been the case, I think, in the White House. I agree with you about the Cheney parallel. I don't think it's there. I don't think that Pence knows enough about the executive branch of government, and so far, at least, because we don't know what his appointments are, it was the Cheney-Rumsfeld link above all, and their ability to place people in key positions in the administration, which made that type of working so ultimately pernicious for President Bush.
Well, about could you address the interesting question about democracy?
That's actually a very good point about democracy. I mean, I think this is one for the sort of the political philosophers to some extent. The inconvenient feature of democracy is that it gives the masses the opportunity to have a say. And the Founding Fathers were very wary of that, but they were also very wary about the concentration of powers. So to some extent, this is a bit of a test of the U.S. Constitution in balancing those two fears. But at the same time, we've got arguably now two new case studies in populism and a populist momentum in both the case of Brexit and in the U.S. case. And populism can be very frightening. It can also be very inconvenient. But sometimes maybe it's warranted. Sometimes it throws into the political arena issues that had been left unresolved and been eclipsed.
I absolutely agree with that. I just say that the concern is that democracies, or many of them, now have problems which it is very difficult for their political system to develop good answers for, because the answers to the problems of our countries are so politically unpalatable that it's very hard to say, look, we need some years of austerity, or we need to allow in free trade or immigration or something, and then please vote for me now and in 4 years' time. And so I think that's part of the predicament we have. And yes, it's great that people vote. What the concern is with both Brexit and with Trump, it seems to me, is that people are voting, asking for something really kind of both romantic and deeply felt and quite specific. Protect me from this thing. Do this thing for me. Build the wall. And actually the politicians can't deliver, and you're going to get more mistrust.
On the democracy issue, Do the Democrats have a legitimate battle cry now to steal from Trump the system's rigged line? Because this will be, if indeed it's confirmed, the sixth out of seventh presidential elections where they have got the most votes. And yet, here we are, two of them quite badly lost. Well, this one very badly lost, and one other actually pretty poorly lost. In other words, that whole, and particularly if the Democrats are increasingly having to rely on urban voters, wanting to rely on urban voters, wanting to appeal to them, that kind of this rural-urban split and the way in which the founding fathers, going back to them again, set it up so that it is the way it is actually going to be increasingly questioned on the left, or am I going too many paces ahead?
I'll take a bite at that apple. Certainly this afternoon, she did not frame the election that way. I don't think that the Democrats will go there. I mean, because this is really then the platform is let's change the Electoral College. We need to, change the Constitution and so forth. I think for the Democrats, the issue here right now is there's two. One is who are the Democrats that could run 4 years from now? Where's the next team? Is it Tim? Is it Kane or are there other people out there? That's one set of questions, but I think more fundamentally, what are the issues that they're going to be able to identify that helps them broaden their coalition? I mean, the thing about the Democratic Party right now is it's made up of African Americans, Latinos, and pretty well-disposed, kind of like upper middle class Americans. And so there's a kind of the constituency that was once kind of bedrock of the party has been hollowed out. And they need to come up with a set of issues that reaches out to those very voters that Trump appealed to, it seems to me. Yeah.
I think I agree with Peter that the Democrats won't challenge this. They won the popular vote, or we think they did, but didn't, but lost the presidency. But I think in their own interest, they might think of that. We can certainly imagine if Trump had won the popular vote and not the presidency, that he would be petitioning for a rethink of the Electoral College system. Because you've absolutely touched on the heart of it, which is this split between the cities, the metropolitan areas, and the rural areas. It was very striking last night that the votes were coming in first from the rural areas, which are not very populated, and very Republican. And then the Democrats were hanging hope on the metropolitan areas, which report later that, well, maybe these wards or these districts will save us, and just not enough in the end. And that, the founding fathers didn't foresee that. They saw all kinds of other need for all kinds of other checks and balances, but not this particular division. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Democrats hoping that demographics were going to kind of tip their way and begin to deliver them the presidency, why it hasn't worked because of this split that delivers individual states.
Yeah. So a further factor just in structural, reform of the political system is the gerrymandering. I mean, you have very few contested districts, and that's a feature aside from the Electoral College that would need to undergo quite substantial reform. So it's not just the Electoral College.
Okay, let's go down to this side. I haven't had anyone from that block yet. Sorry, I'm keeping you on your feet. And then perhaps we could get a microphone down to someone in the middle there as well. Yep, down you go. Yes.
Michael Climes, I'm a journalist. Could you just rate Trump as a communicator? Because although I'm pretty actually scared now that he's president, I do have to say sometimes that he actually did make me laugh every now and then. And he does have a sense of comic timing. And like Make America Great Again, Lying Ted, Little Marco, Crooked Hillary, I mean, those seem to really stick. And none of his opponents from wherever they were, whether it was other politicians, were able to sort of, sum him up rightly or wrongly in a line, and he does seem to have a bit of comic timing. Right.
Political language, use of comedy. Yep, over there.
Hi, I'm doing a master's in comparative politics, and I'm asking myself, is the cause that there is so much anger and dissatisfaction in the population really a change in society or in the economy? Or is it rather with political systems that are not adequately designed for a world with a lot of new issues, such as media that promotes emotions over facts, or mass immigration, or increasing socioeconomic inequality, polarization of views, and also the failure of experts to actually enact solutions that actually work for all the people?
Okay,
so again, the question is it actually on a global scale the failure of political systems to adapt quickly enough? Is it too hard to change political systems?
Gentlemen.
Hi, a concerned grandparent with American grandsons. How do you square Trump's appeal to the blue-collar workers who've been disadvantaged with the neoconservative approach of the Republican Party, low government regulation, low welfare, hire and fire regimes? And what's going to happen when those who voted for Trump, who think we're going to get our jobs back, we're going to get all the factories back again, 2 years down the line, they find nothing's happened?
Right. Yeah. Which is fascinating, isn't it? So anyone from the panel take any of those that takes your fancy?
So I'll take the first one. So the sort of the levity in his rhetoric. Actually, one of the things that sometimes we forget, and I use this in my teaching clips from the Reagan presidency, was his ability to tell jokes. I mean, for those of you who are a bit older might remember, he was actually a quite jokey sort of person. And in fact, it was part of his rhetoric, his anti-Soviet Union rhetoric, was to undermine communism by essentially making it a joke. And actually, that is a feature that Trump has used, that he sort of has this direct line to the common folk, and he talks like them, he speaks like them, and it's part of his appeal. That works on the campaign trail. Whether it will work in office, we'll see.
Mm. I think you'd say, looking back, four of the last six American presidents, so all but maybe the two Bushes, have plainly been outstanding communicators with an element of performance. I mean, Reagan, Clinton, Obama, and now Trump, I think, have extraordinary communication skills in different ways. I mean, not all the same. Not all of them are able to use humor in quite the way. There wouldn't be the Obama style. But I think that's not exactly the norm, but it's the preferred model.
And the system being broken? A very important question.
I'll happily take that one. I think you could argue that there are some trends that were going on already that were making it very, very hard for conventional politicians to run and be elected. One, you could say, is the sort of building up of this kind of the expensiveness of the social contract, all the promises made over years about health, education, pensions, just getting very, very hard for countries to manage as populations got older. You could say a bit the same about these international pacts and alliances. Just the burden was falling and is falling very hard on America, and it was getting fed up with that. And I think the financial crisis made this worse, but only a bit. These things were going on anyway. So I think there are trends there that really were putting a lot of pressure. We're asking for an upset, if you like, in the conventional.
And to the concerned parent or grandparent, was it?
So this was a question of like how you square the circle, like how do you, you've got an internally divided Republican Party, and I think that's right. I mean, you could frame it as it's like Trump. Is it Trump's party or is it Ryan's party? And I think Trump just demonstrated to Paul Ryan that he's got a lot of people behind him. And so I think Ryan is going to have to be careful with him. So I suspect. Is that they will look for those few issues, those issues where they have some common ground. But at the same time, if I were advising Trump, I think a smart advisor, maybe not myself, but somebody else, they would tell him to craft or to combine maybe his interest in infrastructure, right, which would put a lot of money into the system and deal with the kinds of concerns you just raised, but maybe couple it with concerns or issues that more traditional Republicans, you know, consider important, and to try to coalition build that way or govern that way.
Good luck with the American kids, by the way. I've got an American child, 12-year-old child, who is American but is also very South London, in as much as when I said he wants to build a wall between the United States and Mexico, she said, wouldn't he have to get planning permission? Which is properly British as well as American, I think. Okay, yes, someone right down at the front here, and then if you could go right across to those two people waving, in fact, the three people waving the other side. Can you get across there? No, you can't physically. No? Okay. We'll come a different way to you. Yeah.
Hi, it's Mr. Prem Pararaja. I'd just like to ask the panel, do you think he's going to be a better domestic leader than an international leader? Will he be able to build credibility quickly with the other international leaders, including Angela Merkel, the other European leaders, and the Israeli leader? And do you think they'll listen to him, or do you think they'll switch off?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, isn't it? How are they going to treat him? How are they going to treat him? Interesting, Theresa May has written to him. I don't... she might tell you all you need to know. And if you go all the way up to the top, please, and get those people there. Yeah. Here we go.
Hi. I'm interested in the fact that race was barely mentioned in the talk. And I feel like what I've seen is we've been teetering between narratives of economic anxiety, education, and race. But should this be a wake-up call for white people, especially white liberals, that maybe they're oblivious about the reality of demographic anxiety in their racial group, and we use words like nationalism, populism, and racism, but maybe we don't have the language to describe the othering that we're seeing in the U.S. and maybe in Brexit as well?
That's a fascinating one, isn't it? And right over in the corner there, can we get the microphone across to her so that I'm... seem to be delving into both corners of the room.
Hi, I'm reading PPE at Oxford. I was just wondering, in a lot of the political discussions that I've heard so far, we've kind of brushed over the allegations of sexual assault. And I was just wondering, you know, especially only a few months after the Stanford rape case and the controversy surrounding that, now that Trump has won the presidency, will those issues be brushed under the carpet? And if so, what kind of message does that send to sexual assault victims across the world?
Yeah, on the sexual assault, it's interesting. I talked to the lawyer for several of the women who've come forward. And what she was saying, this is before, obviously, that it won. But she was saying that if he goes after them, then he would be in deep trouble and he'd have to appear in court and all the rest of it. But I think she was suggesting that if he didn't sue them for libel, then that was probably the end of the matter. Mm-hmm. Is that the right way of... I mean, is that your understanding of where... Does anyone have any kind of sense of where those assault... Because it was serious stuff, and you think of the numbers of women who came forward, the detail of the allegations, and yet now it probably, I think probably what you said finally is true, that it actually just rests there and doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be their prime purpose, as far as you can tell, was to try and disrupt his run for the presidency. They wanted people to know as well, you know, by coming forward, they thought, you know, I want the world to know this, and they were emboldened by the tapes that came out. In saying that, whether or not any of them choose to pursue it now, agreed, I'm doubtful, but we don't know. They're presumably taking stock. There would have to be sort of, I think they would have to feel that there was quite a case they could bring. It is amazing to me that the sort of allegations in that tape didn't stick more. They obviously did him some damage, but not that much at the end.
Race. Anyone want to pick up on that?
Just on the sexual.
Oh, okay. If you've got something to add, yeah.
One of the things that is intriguing, it differentiates the Bill Clinton administration from an upcoming Trump administration, is this question about, you know, misconduct, whatever you want to call it, the allegations of sexual assault. Now, over the weekend, you know, my family were sort of contemplating the impeachment, whether Hillary Clinton would win, or impeachment if Trump would win. Both plausibly have a case to answer to. But I think that it would be entirely implausible in the case of Trump, simply because both houses of Congress. I mean, you would have to have the House of Representatives bring up the impeachment charges, and presumably, you know, high crimes and misdemeanors, however you want to characterize the allegations. But that's pretty unlikely, unless, as you say, Trump would pursue things.
What about on Trump University, though? Is he slightly still on the hook with that legally? Because, I mean, that's a court case. It's not an impeachment proceeding, but it's quite a serious court case, potentially.
It should come forward, right. It should move forward on its own, on right. its own steam, and he might have to deal with it while he's president. I mean, he will have to
okay.
deal with it. President.
I'm very keen to get on to race. I'm also, this interesting question about how he's treated by foreign leaders. Perhaps that's one for you, Nigel.
Yeah, on the first question, I actually think that if you're successful on the domestic stage, then it's broadly the same set of skills that you're going to need internationally. You're going to need to do your homework on people and issues, get under the surface. You're going to need some patience. You're going to need some emotional intelligence to understand what's in the mind of the people on the other side of the negotiation.
Well, it can't go wrong then, can it?
I don't know. We'll have to see. It goes back to our earlier discussion about what sort of President Trump shows up and whether he shows the temperament, which at the moment is clearly lacking and in doubt. I think everyone, I think other leaders will do what Theresa May did today, and that is approach this with almost a sort of straight bat. They'll say what's necessary to establish the fundamentals, the basics of a relationship, in a very, very wary way. I think when he gets into the White House on the 20th of January, he's going to want some friends around the world. He wants a bit of support, not necessarily instant adulation, but something out there. And there's a diplomatic game that's always played between countries at this time of the season to get the first phone call in, if you want to get the first phone call in, and which one is taken by the transition team, number one. And number two, who gets through the door first of the White House after inauguration. That was always something that British prime ministers wanted to be the first through the White House door, if not the first, because that's often Canada or Mexico, maybe unlikely to be Mexico this time, or Japan. But we normally want to be the first European through their door. Will that be the case
Well, there hasn't been a rush this afternoon. No. I mean, there's been silence from France and, as you said, a letter from Theresa May.
Yeah. Right. Formal and not closing doors, I think, at this stage.
Okay. Race, anyone?
Well, I want to be sure I've understood the question correctly. I think what you were saying, you forgive me if I've got it wrong, was that Democrats have sort of assumed that because of the historic support they've got from ethnic minorities and because of some of the apparently racist things that Trump said, that they would have a lot of support from ethnic minorities, and that isn't quite...
No, that's not my question.
It isn't what happened. All right, so say what you want.
My question is that, is this a wake-up call for white, specifically white liberals, that... You know, we thought this was a conversation about education, that these are poor, uneducated white people in America, in rural areas who are voting for Trump. And it seems like the numbers are not coming out that way, that this is white college educated and they're not as poor as we think they are who are voting for Trump as well. Is there something there for white liberals on the Democratic side to think about their racial group? So not thinking about ethnic minorities and how they're voting, but white people as a racial group. Does that make more sense?
Yeah, I think I can speak to that. So, I mean, I think you have to separate out the kind of, in a sense, the white college-educated Republicans that ended up voting for Trump, but in fact held out till the very end, really. And those non-college-educated whites that were backing him from the get-go and were in the tank. There were more of them than people realize. I think in the first group, the reason they voted for Trump in the end was because that was a vote against Hillary Clinton. It's easy to forget in all of this, the country is deeply polarized along partisan lines. And so for many Republicans, the idea of voting for a Democrat, especially Hillary Clinton, was just, you know, that was like a bridge too far. I think for the non-college educated, it's not... You know, like they're ignorant about their circumstances. I mean, I think the problem there is that these people feel and have felt for some time that their life fortunes are kind of, you know, they're not improving, and more importantly, that their kids' life fortunes do not look good. The possibility of their kids going to college and so forth. And I think that makes them very ripe for the plucking when it comes to, which is what I took your question to be, kind of racist rhetoric and so forth. I mean, they're vulnerable to that. And so I think Trump kind of fused those things together. It's not that racism doesn't have an autonomous, independent status in American politics. Clearly does. But I think in this circumstance, it was playing on this sense of a group that felt like they have been left behind, that goods are being distributed to other groups in society, but not them. And whether that's right or wrong, I think, is a separate question.
Okay, maybe we've got time for three or four more. So someone down from the middle, please. And then, yes, that chap at the back, and maybe you can kick us off. Here we go. Microphone's right next to you. There you go.
Right, so I come from Vilnius, Lithuania, and obviously we are very scared of what happened. And, you know, Lithuanians traditionally supported Republicans and John McCain-type Republicans, but obviously this year we supported Hillary Clinton. So my question is there enough political will in the Republican Party and in the American political system to ensure that no matter what, you know, president does, there is, you know, NATO stands and NATO stands firm?
Yeah, okay, good one. And then someone at the front here, right. Who's got the microphone? Yes.
Yes. My first question is that there have been some accounts which have compared Brexit and Trump's victory as being reactions against globalization. I'd like to know what your views on this are. My second question has to do with the U.S. electoral process and the effect Trump's election will have on the way that candidates now run and the kind of language that is used by candidates to appeal to people in general.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And you might add money as well to that, which we haven't really touched on. But my goodness, it's interesting that Bernie Sanders and Trump, both of them, took an approach to running that is unusual. Here we go. Right. Here we go.
Seems to be something Shakespearean about what's happened with Hillary Clinton, to come so far, to have planned this long, and to have just had it taken away when it was in her grasp. What would a fair and balanced assessment of Hillary Clinton's political career and legacy look like?
Okay, shoot on any of those. That's like a sort of any questions question, Nigel, and you're on any questions. It's exactly the sort of question you get up in Cambridge. It's good practice for you. So, yeah, take your pick. Peter, you look as if you want to kick
I'll take the Vilnius question.
Go. Yeah.
So I think what Trump will learn pretty early, because I think there will be some testing, is that Americans also don't like it when and American presidents are pretty uncomfortable being perceived as weak. So if there's testing, what will happen is international testing, a test of kind of American resolve and so forth. He will be under domestic pressure to respond. And so I think while he may want to walk back a number of commitments, there's going to be a countervailing pressure that he'll have to deal with. And maybe given Trump's communication skills, he'll be able to overcome that. But I think that's the tension there. And so I don't think it's he just gets to walk away and say, you know, kind of, no mas, not my problem, you know. There'll be people, there'll be Americans who say this is a problem, people within his own party.
Any of the others?
Could I take the Hillary Clinton? Let me broaden the scope for the question about Hillary Clinton into, which we haven't really discussed yet, the role of gender and the prospect of a woman, a first ever woman president. I remember back in 2008 thinking that, especially in the Democratic primaries, how acceptable sexist rhetoric seemed to be in American political discourse. It was sort of laughed off, it was reported, and isn't that sort of humorous? And whereas the equivalent
to my mind, offensive racist rhetoric would not even be republished, published in or stated. It would be stricken from the record. And so I think that Hillary Clinton has made great strides, and I'd had hoped for a first woman president. I think that this is, once again, a very perplexing and fascinating issue, why America seems to have a barrier to electing a woman president. One is the role itself entails commander-in-chief, and that's a very masculine-type role that I think Americans have a difficulty wrapping their heads around, having a woman in that capacity. Moreover, it's a presidential system. It's not a parliamentary system. So you look at, in a parliamentary system, Margaret Thatcher being a perfect example, she worked her way up to the ranks through the party, and that's very different. The challenge, I think, is a lot more difficult in a presidential system. So I think that with regard to women, women as commander-in-chief, women as president, we were tantalizingly close. We're not there yet. And whether Hillary Clinton has set us back, I don't know. There are some suspicion or some talk now, maybe Michelle Obama. But I think what's fairly clear from this episode is that Americans are probably pretty fed up with political dynasties. Mm. And going down the route of another political dynasty is probably not.
Angelina Jolie, perhaps, who is a distinguished professor at this university. Yeah.
Okay. Shall I try Trump and Brexit?
Yeah, do.
I don't know. I think globalization is a sort of subset of them. I think it's very difficult to parse exactly what caused our referendum result on the 23rd of June. If you look at the exit polls for yesterday's election, the economy was the single biggest thing on voters' minds. And the largest, I think a plurality, but nevertheless a significant number of people said that they'd voted the way they did because they wanted change. And Trump was the person seen as delivering that. So I think that what links the two is this sense of acute and growing economic inequalities and unfairness, combined with railing against a political establishment which is seen as inadequate to deal with that. And globalization maybe is the umbrella which is easy to attack. But I think it's in a way much more general than that. And I think there is a link between the two. And for those who are going to have elections after the American one in Europe over the next year, this is a very, very worrying phenomenon indeed. I don't know whether Marine Le Pen sent a tweet or a message or a letter or whatever. She was pretty quick to get out. And many of the themes that you see coming back to the question about language, there are similarities in the language used by the insurgent parties here in Western Europe, UKIP, the National Front, and so on, and the language used by Trump very, very successfully.
And can you also just address that question of the money that I kind of tacked on to that question about language? So it is interesting, isn't it, that these are... You think of Sanders and you think of Trump, they've run in different ways. Sanders more conventional in as much as he was already in the Senate, but the way that he raised money, mm-hmm. really interesting. And Trump, of course, he's not spent that much, has he, in historic terms?
He said $100 million.
Yeah, well, there you go.
I guess that's nothing.
Not sure exactly we don't even know if that's true.
$69,
I was reading somewhere he'd spent more on hats to give out at his rallies than he spent on polling.
Right.
Which is quite something, isn't it? Is that a model now?
He must have been
making
money.
That if you're going to run for the presidency, you can raise money in different ways. You do it in a way where you don't have to spend a huge amount on television advertising. That model is broken.
Well, there's an interesting similarity actually between what Sanders did, I guess, and what Trump did. So Trump's argument was, made this a lot during the Republican primaries, that he didn't want to take anybody's money. That he knew what that entailed, that he would have to provide policies and goods to individuals and so that people could trust him because he was going to just use his own money. And in Sanders' case, he also did not take money really from large donors. The whole idea was to do this through small donations. Now, it may have been that was the only real path open to him, given that Clinton was getting most of the money from the large Democratic donors, and that he made a kind of a virtue out of it. But nevertheless, right, the model was the same. I'm not beholden to anybody.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But the corollary is that you need to be more outrageous and more attention-seeking in your media approach in order to get the media to follow you without paying for ads and everything else. So so that, I think, is probably the downside in more self-financing and more going after the ordinary voter and the ordinary supporter.
Fantastic. Hold on to your hats. 4 more years. A round of applause, please, for our panellists and for everyone who's taken part. Thank you very much.